Hello, I'm Kirsty Young, and this is a podcast from the Desert Island Discs archive. For rights reasons, we've had to shorten the music. The programme was originally broadcast in 1998, and the presenter was Sue Lawley.
My castaway this week is a sculptor. After a fairly conventional upbringing, he was born in London, went to a Catholic public school and then to Cambridge, he set off to travel the world. In India, he learned to focus on his own body through meditation, and once back in England, began to develop the idea of body sculptures, using his own as the main model for his work. In 1994, he won the Turner Prize, and earlier this year, unveiled a piece which will unquestionably attract lasting public attention. Overlooking the motorway outside Gateshead, it's called the Angel of the North. 65 feet high and with the wingspan of a jumbo jet, it's a permanent example of its creator's belief that art should have a place outside galleries and museums. He is Anthony Gormley. Indeed, I think, Anthony, your angel can claim to be the most viewed piece of sculpture in the world, can't it? I think somebody estimated 33 million a year pass by it.
That sounds incredible. I think we have to wait and see, but it's certainly more in one year than I could ever hope to reach doing gallery shows.
And that's a statistic that delights you, is it? That's what you like?
I think it's terribly important to liberate art from the straitjacket of both the museum and the private gallery. I think both of them are very, very specialised spaces that in some way are almost like hospitals in the kind of support that they give for what they show. And I think it's very important to see whether art can survive as part of the fabric of the built world, and that's what the experiment of making the angel was all about.
But it's an uncomfortable, if I may say so, piece of work, isn't it? It's an odd mixture of the body and the aeroplane, really. These huge wings on the side that look very ungainly. This rather fine body, your body.
Thank you, Sue.
In the middle there.
I think that the point is that it's an angel that's lost its innocence. This is the image, in a sense, of those powers that formerly we attributed to divine or angelic forces that we have firmly within our own grasp. You know, we can fly, we can hear voices like in this medium of bodies that are absent. There is a sense in which the body has been extended, probably more in the 20th century than in any other time, by the technology that human beings have invented, that has given us powers that would formerly have been considered godlike. Now, this angel, I think, has those attributes, but by having wings has lost its arms and has lost those faculties of humankind to make and to embrace and to be part of the fellowship of man. And I think it's asking very serious questions about our relationship with our tools, whether these are enablers or burdens. And I think it's an ambivalent image.
So, but there's undoubtedly, and indeed you confirm it in what you say, a wariness about the time in which we live and perhaps a wariness about the future.
Well, I think we are all aware that there are more people on this planet, that there are more wars between those people that live on the planet, that in some senses none of the benefits of technology seem to have solved the basic problems of human existence. And I think slowly we're realizing that actually we have to solve these things for ourselves. We're no longer God's children born to do his will, as I was taught as a child, but that somehow we have to be creative people, all of us, artists and non-artists alike, in making the future, and that is a serious responsibility, and I hope that that's what this image is about. It's not about some divine messenger that is going to, in a sentimental way, give us comfort. It's actually about recognizing what it means to be human now.
Tell me about your first record.
My first record is from 1968. It's the White Album of the Beatles, Happiness is a Warm Gun. For me, this period is about me, in a way, escaping from the confines of home. becoming aware of a wider world in which sex and drugs and rock and roll were all part of the blandishments of growing up. And I think it has the most fantastic, surreal lyrics that obviously are to do with sex, but they're also to do with violence. There's also a wonderful moment in it which describes a touch like a velvet hand on a window pane. And in a sense, there's something about that that connects with sculpture for me. Something about touch, something that invites touch, something that engages us physically.
Beatles and Happiness is a Warm Gun from the White Album. Unlike the Angel of the North, Anthony Gormley, your work in the main is on a life-size scale, isn't it? Real scale in the real world. Lead or iron figures sitting or standing or hanging at impossible angles halfway up a wall. But it's always your body. The mould is taken from your body, which means that somebody else has to make the plaster cast on you. Why does it have to be your body?
Well, I think, you know, the traditional image of the sculptor, particularly the male sculptor, is somebody that makes an idealised female body, hopefully very sexy, at arm's length, out of a lump of marble. And I think the problem with that is that it is all at arm's length. It's about making a resemblance, often, or an idealisation. And I want to make my work about life, about the lived moment. And I want to make it from the inside rather than from the outside.
So the space inside the sculptor is as important to you as the space outside?
Absolutely. And I think until recently, all of the work was hollow. I mean, I call them body cases. I don't call them figures because, in fact, they're just a kind of very intimate architecture that represents not the body, but the space that the body occupies. Mm.
But how do you do it? You take off all your clothes.
Take off all my clothes. I started covering myself in Vaseline, but that's very, very, very sticky and unpleasant. So I very swiftly moved on to cling film as the best membrane to separate you from the plaster.
I think that's pretty uncomfortable, isn't it?
Well, actually, in wintertime, in a cold studio, you're very, very thankful.
Because after the cling film, you have lots of plaster of Paris put on you, little bits of gauze and scrim and so on. Eventually, you are totally encased, and you can only breathe through a tiny little orifice of the mouth or the nose. What do you do? Put a straw up your nose?
No, I don't like the straw up the nose. I have used that. I usually do breathe out of my mouth.
I've seen pictures of you doing it. I mean, it's because you're pretty encased, literally.
Well, I think the point is that you have to, I think, be in a certain frame of mind, and you have to be able to be extremely still. And if you're concentrating very hard on being very still, you're not breathing very heavily. You don't need a lot of air, actually.
So are you meditating inside there?
Well, I think the process definitely comes out of my experience of meditation in India, and that certainly gave me my first experience of this idea of the space of the body. I mean, when you close your eyes and you're awake, you are in a space. And I remember having very powerful experiences as a child before sleep of that space behind the eyes. First of all, being very, very contained, like in a tiny compressed little matchbox of a space, and it would be very, very frightening and claustrophobic. And then as I spent time in it, it would open out and open out, and somehow it would get cooler and more like the night sky but without stars, that went on and on and on. And in some senses I found that space again in meditation, and that's where I go when I am being moulded.
Hmm.
And I do it with my wife, who's, you know, extremely adept, and with whom I have profound trust. And in a sense, she's responsible for, you know, giving me birth every time.
But eventually she has to cut you out of this case with a little saw. Can that be a bloody business?
Yes, it can. Actually, it was very funny. We we had been using, you know, fret saw blades because they seemed like a reasonable tool. And then I was teaching in the Fine Arts Academy in Munich, and this young student was making body casting, and he said, oh, you must get one of these Swiss plaster saws. They're just the thing. And we did use it. And I'm still carrying the scars today. I have a seam line that runs almost all around me. And I didn't feel, the saw was so sharp that I didn't feel what was happening. But that was the bloodiest moment that has ever occurred. You know, the occasional little bit of bloodletting isn't a bad thing, I don't think.
Tell me about record number two.
Record number two is Hari Prasad Chaurasia playing Raga Jai Jaivanti. This is just the most wonderful sound in the world. And it reminds me of my time in Adyar, which is in South India, near to Madras. I stayed for 3 months in the headquarters of the Theosophical Society, which has a wonderful park. And in the middle of the park is a great banyan tree. And every evening, a flute player would come and sit and play this kind of music.
Hari Prasad Chaurasia and Dilshad Khan playing Raga Jai Jai Vanti. India then, Anthony, was where you decided to become a sculptor, was it?
Yes, it was. I had a choice, it seemed to me, between carrying on with my Buddhist meditation and maybe entering a monastery and becoming a Buddhist monk, or returning to the West and becoming a sculptor.
Why a sculptor more than any other kind of artist?
It's the most challenging of work. I mean, I think I got quite good at drawing and, you know, making pictures of things, making representations of things.
What, as a child?
Well, as a child and during my travels before I went to art school.
But did you sculpt at all?
I remember at school taking an old carpentry chisel and trying to carve the cliff behind the house. I was at St. Wilfrid's, which was sort of up on a hill, and there was this big limestone cliff. And I started with this, you know, about a 5-foot-high face.
You also buried things as a child, didn't you?
Yeah, I did a lot of that. I had a museum when I was about 6. My maternal grandfather gave me a wonderful collection of Iron Age and Neolithic and Stone Age implements, hafted stone axes and that kind of thing. And that, the idea of getting things out of the ground that were connected very closely with people's lives and bodies.
Which is why you went on to study archaeology, of course.
Yeah, maybe. But the idea that I could contribute to that and sort of make things that would, as it were, exist in a different time frame to human life. And I think that's the really exciting thing about sculpture. It's an incredibly resistant and stupid thing to be doing at the end of the 20th century, which is, you know, as it were, speed technology and the speed of electronic communication is the thing that gets us all so excited. And here is sculpture that in some senses goes at geological time and is, you know, in a way resisting all of that.
But this is wonderfully still. That's the whole point, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I think if you think of what the primal gesture of sculpture is, which is, in a sense, the standing stone, taking something that's lying on the surface of the earth, and by this simple gesture of standing it vertical, it becomes a marker in time, in space. It says, here we are, we exist, and this is, in a way, a proof of our existence. And against this, we can measure our existence. Well, all of those things, I think, are at the heart, the essential condition of sculpture, which is what I get very, very excited about.
So Tell me about your next record. That's number three.
My next record is Lou Reed, Walking on the Wild Side. This record reminds me of Andy Warhol, of the Velvet Underground, of, in a way, my first tastes of New York, of the merging of boundaries, of transsexuality, of, I guess, all of the Puritan moral values that, in some senses, cripples America being countered by this fantastic, iconoclastic spirit.
Holly came from Miami, FLA, hitchhiked her way across USA, plucked her eyebrows on the way, shaved her legs, and then he was a she. She says, hey, babe, take a walk on the wild side. Said, hey, honey, take a walk on the wild side.
Lou Reed and Walk on the Wild Side. So, Cambridge, India, decide not to be Buddhist monk, come back here, art school, and you begin to work. You begin to... Now, a lot of that early work, it seemed to me, the body was very absent. There were kind of, well, you describe them, sheets draped over figures.
Yeah, I got... One of the first pieces that I got involved with on coming back from India was trying to recreate the experience of early morning in Calcutta railway station, where, you know, every 5 yards there's somebody sleeping under a dhoti where they've used their the cloth that normally they would use around their waists as a kind of tent. And it's very, very powerful, somehow, that abstraction. This is the minimum space that one person needs to occupy. It looks like a very fine shell. And, you know, this is where somebody lives. And in a way, you don't know. It's a bit like Schrodinger's cat. You don't know whether they're alive or dead, actually. Mm. And that's a very real thing in India.
So you soaked a sheet in plaster and set it.
And placed it not over myself, but over... I got various of my friends to lie on the floor and took, actually, old hospital sheets, immersed them in plaster and just placed them over their bodies. And they were the very first body sculptures that I made, but they were very patently, evidently, like empty shells.
Yes, but as I say, the body wasn't on view, and neither was it in another of your pieces of work, which I think people well may recall, called Bed, which is a kind of double mattress made out of, what, 6,000 slices of stale old mother's pride?
Yes, it was about 600 loaves that we got, so I don't know what the... Yes, it is about 6,000. No, it'll be more than that. It would be 600 times... I think there's 23 slices in an average medium-sliced Mother's Pride loaf.
But you laid them out and formed this beautiful bed. And
yes,
then
it was
you...
about the size of a double bed, and over about 4 months I ate my own volume out of that pile.
You personally ate it?
Yes, I wouldn't advise anybody else to do it unless they wanted to recreate this experiment. But
no butter, no jam.
I'd worked it out very carefully. There was a drawing on the wall, and I knew how many slices I had to eat each day. In the process of this, obviously, this very highly factory-produced and synthetic foodstuff actually became mouldy, and so it did begin another form of organic existence. And each slice became like a field because it had these wonderful kind of patterns of green mould.
Next record.
The next record is Iwao Yonetani playing Tokachi Umauta, which is, it's a shakuhachi flute. And the first time I came across this instrument played live was when I was walking across Ueno Park, and I saw this white-dressed figure with a basket over its head with a flute coming out of it, and it was somebody playing the shakuhachi. And I think there's nothing quite like it, this minor key, this haunting, misty immediately you're in this misty Japanese rocky landscape, immersed in an elemental world.
Iwao Yanetani playing Tokachi Umatu. And then, Anthony Gormley, after 1981, your work, it seems to me, changed radically because the human body became present. It was no longer an imprint. Was there a reason for that radical change?
Well, I'd been, using my body in implied ways. I'd made bed, and then I made room, which was actually my own clothes, peeled off me and made into an enclosure that was about 20 foot square that looked a bit like a boxing ring. And it seemed very obvious that the next step was to actually use my body directly, both as material, as tool, and as subject.
But I've seen it suggested that it coincided with your you and Vikan producing your first baby, and I wondered if there was something in that.
That's an intriguing idea, that Ivo and the body cases arrive at the same time.
But it's just the perhaps it's a heightened sense of the vulnerability, if you like, of the human form.
Everybody has remarked on the similarity between my work and the figures in Pompeii and Herculaneum. I think there is a sense in which those works come out of the results of a natural disaster. And in a sense, I think that the abiding concern of my work is to make forms that in some way warn or provide some kind of talisman against the potential of a humanly created disaster. So that idea of mortality is very linked to what I conceive of as their reason for being.
What do your children say about your work?
They're very, very open-minded. I mean, in the way that only children can be, and they're completely unawed by it. I can remember Guy, when he was seven, coming into the studio when I'd just made Iron Man, which is a piece in the centre of Birmingham, which is 22 foot high, and I was, rather pleased with myself. I thought this was an impressive bit of work. He came into the studio, he said, "Daddy, head's too big." And he just climbed straight up the scaffolding and got somebody to give him a saw and started kind of, and he was absolutely right. There was no question about it. He's always been like that.
It's probably good for you, isn't
it? Yes.
Record number five.
Record number five is the wonderful Gilberto Gil with his version of Stevie Wonder's I Just Called to Say I Love You. I've been lucky enough to spend some very, very happy times in Brazil, both in the Amazon making field and in Rio. And I just think it's one of those blessed places on the face of this earth.
Não é Natal, nem ano bom, nenhum sinal no céu, nenhum Armagedon, nenhuma data especial.
Gilberto Gil with his Portuguese version of Stevie Wonder's I Just Called to Say I Love You. You mentioned Field just now, which is one of the works, the series of works for which you won the Turner Prize in 84. Let's describe, first of all, how you did it, Field. Just describe me, because you've done it in various parts of the world now, haven't you?
Yes, I mean, Field necessitates getting 50 tonnes of clay and anything up to 200 people and sitting down and remaking the population of the world, but in hand-sized body surrogates.
Those people and, making them.
Yeah. And
what directions do you give them when you...
There's only three rules. One is that they should be hand-sized. The other is that they should stand up. And the third is that they should have eyes that look in one direction.
So they squeeze these things in their hands.
And everybody finds their own way to make it. And when it's made, we then completely occupy a gallery to the complete exclusion of the audience. So you can't get into the building.
You can only peer through the
door. Or you can't get into the bit of the building that this occupation is taking place in. And you look through the door. And unwittingly, you have become the subject of the art.
Because all those vacant eyes are looking at
yes.
you.
Yes. People laugh and people cry.
How does it differ, though? Because you've done it in Australia, Brazil, St. Helens in Lancashire, Sweden, the Amazon.
Yeah.
Are they different?
It's very, very dangerous, this, I think. But, I mean, there's no question that the British field looks like animated root vegetables. The Swedish field looks like tortured monk scream kind of figures. They're very, very psychotic. And then the Mexican field, which was actually all made by blood-related people. This one family, Donna Pasquale, had had 22 children, and 18 of them worked on field with their wives and children. Has the greatest consistency of form, and the forms are incredibly pure.
Record number 6.
Is Martin Hayes. I'm playing Brown Coffin, which is a traditional jig, but played by somebody who became a very accomplished jazz musician. And that lilting, wonderful plangency of the Irish... very Celtic feeling is slightly modified by a kind of modernist jazz idiom.
Martin Hayes playing the Brown Coffin, accompanied by Randall Bays on the guitar. And now, Anthony Gormley, you're taking on the Royal Academy because you want to take over the courtyard in the front there to coincide with the summer exhibition. What do you want to do in it?
Well, I made a piece 3 years ago called Critical Mass. It's 12 sculptures that have been cast 5 times each. And actually, they describe a kind of evolution. The smallest one is very, very crouched and looks at the ground. And the tallest one is actually standing and looking at the sky. But none of them are going to be presented in the way that they were moulded. They'll all be either hanging upside down from the facade of the building or lying as if after a massacre in the central reservation of the courtyard. And the idea is really very simple. I think that the Academy, with its royal prefix, represents in a way a kind of hierarchy of Western values with its celebration of cultural heroes. There's a frieze of Michelangelo, Cellini, Rembrandt, that is over the front doors of the Academy. And I thought this was a very apposite place to think about the victims of the 20th century. And I think there are very strong references in this work to Rwanda, to Cambodia, to the more recent conflicts of Bosnia.
And again, your work will be outside the gallery, not inside it. And
that's
again,
right.
You will have this procession of people. I mean, Middle England will pass by for the summer exhibition.
Yes, I hope it'll give them something to think about. I think
you're
it's
smiling
a perfect.
When you
it's,
say
a,
that.
It's a perfect context. I think it is a perfect context for making a work that I think talks about, in some senses, what lies or what is the price for the elevation of the body.
Record number 7.
Record number 7 is this extraordinary bit of music by Chris Isaacs called Wicked Game. Now, I first heard this at the Chisholm Hale Gallery when I went to see an installation by Pippa Lotti Rist, who's a Swiss artist who makes videos. And the video projection was of this fantastic blue undersea world with shafts of sunlight and Pipilotti herself swimming about with pink teacups coming from one side or the other. And ever since I saw that video, I can't hear this music without thinking of that watery world.
The world was on fire and no one could save me but you. Strange world desire will make foolish people.
Chris Isaacs and Wicked Game. Well, now, Anthony, could you hack it on a desert island?
Oh, yeah. I'm looking
forgotten
forward
about
to it.
That, Ben. Are you?
I think I was lying in my bath this morning and thinking about this island. I've got a very clear picture of it. It's about 5 miles long and 3 miles wide. And it has quite a rocky mountain at one end that has grassy bits on it. And I thought I'd probably spend summer nights on the grassy bit because I might get a bit fed up with the sound of the breaking surf down by the sea. I don't think I would be desperate to try and reinvent civilization. I think that I would want to try and find a way of living that was in tune with whatever was possible there. And I hope that there are, you know, enough breadfruit trees or yeah, what I'd really like is mango, papaya, guava and banana, and I would be really very happy.
Last record?
My last record is David Bowie and his wonderful song Starman. From a very small boy, I've always been really moved by that head at the Museum of Mankind. And the fact that it is an example of those heads that stare up into the sky, in some way witnessing the fact that human life is not the only life in this universe.
There's a starman waiting in the sky. He's told us not to blow it, 'cause he knows it's all worthwhile. He told me, let the children lose it, let the children use it, let all the children do get it.
David Bowie and Starman. If you could only take one of the 8 records, Anthony, which one would you take?
I think I'd have Hari Prasad, because he'd keep me company.
What about your book?
Well, I've had Ernst Bloch's Principle of Hope sitting on my shelves waiting for me to have the time to read it. And it's 3 volumes, and it is a study of utopia, its failure, but our continuing need of it.
And your luxury?
I'm going to spend my time with the fishes, so I would like I'd like a snorkel and mask, please. Can I have both?
You can.
Thank you.
Anthony Gormley, thank you very much indeed for letting us hear your Desert Island Discs.
Thank you.
You've been listening to a podcast from the Desert Island Discs archive. For more podcasts, please visit bbc.co.uk/radio4.